Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what happens to the women who join ISIS? We'll spend this hour with journalist Azadeh Moavini, who got to know 13 women who joined the Islamic State in search of community, adventure, or religious fulfillment, only to find themselves nearly powerless in the caliphate, expected to marry and remarry as their warrior husbands were almost inevitably killed in the endless fighting. We'll talk with Moavini about the political and social conditions that drove young women to leave their lives in Germany, the UK, and elsewhere to join up with ISIS, and why those who regret the decision may find it impossible to ever return home. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
When the Islamic State took shape in the aftermath of upheaval in Syria and Iraq, young men who signed on were willing to suffer, fight, and die to establish a caliphate. But it was never just young men. Women have been part of the effort, drawn to promises that the Islamic homeland controlled by ISIS would offer them dignity, opportunity, companionship, even love, all in an environment that didn't discriminate against them for their faith. They left behind homes and families in the UK, Germany, Tunisia, and elsewhere to join a cause they thought would save them, only to discover hazards they never imagined in the caliphate itself. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Azadeh Moavini is a contributor to the New York Times, The Guardian, and the London Review of Books, and she spent several years as Middle East correspondent for Time magazine. She got to know a number of women who made a choice most of us can't fathom, to be part of the Islamic State. But as we'll hear, at the time, each of them believed she was making a moral and logical decision. The new book is called Guest House for Young Widows, The Women of ISIS. Azadeh, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you say if we truly want to understand the conditions that made it possible for ISIS to recruit women, we need to look at the women who joined with more nuance and also compassion. How have their lives and decisions been oversimplified in typical accounts?
In most of the coverage about the rise of ISIS and women's interactions with it, everything has been boiled down to religion, just religious ideology, and maybe a problem with Islam itself. That has left out all of the political context. ISIS, of course, has a very particular story in almost every country that it touched, but certainly in the Middle East, it arose in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, which we know were, you know, a series of uprisings in which women were very active, hoping for new pathways to politics, looking for empowerment, looking for a kind of end to the systems of authoritarianism that they had lived under. And we know that for women, living under an authoritarian order is a double challenge, because you're dealing with patriarchy and then no access to politics to deal with it. So all of this was, to my mind, you know, a big part of the story. ISIS saw how women were so active in these uprisings, and it tapped into the same frustrations and desires. And I thought that was really left out of the story, which really focused on, understandably, the horror, but religion as the explanation.
As recently as a decade or so, Al-Qaeda leaders insisted there were no women in the organization. Their only role was as wives and homemakers looking after the mujahideen. How was ISIS different in its vision for women, or did it simply pledge a different vision for women?
ISIS promised women full-scale membership. It was the first jihadist group to really do that. And it very savvily, I think, noticed that women were at the forefront of these protests, that, well, women were really a social and political force in the Arab world, that this was a generation of young women that expected to have a role that was very active. So it offered them, yes, not just the traditional baby-making role that had been the kind of conventional jihadist offer to women, the Al-Qaeda's of old, but it promised that women could come and be members. They could participate in whatever they were skilled to do. If they were doctors, they could come be doctors in the caliphate. If they were graphic designers, they could do that. Of course, we know that when they arrived, the reality was very different, that it was, you know, these promises of participating in this utopian state-building project quickly gave way to this, you know, horrific genocidal, you know, the realities that we know ISIS to be. But the promises were very real. And for some, in some instances, at the beginning, you know, they were able to take those steps. But I mean, I think to understand why such a perverse offer of empowerment could have even sounded plausible to women, we have to go back to the circumstances of the countries they came from.
So, yeah, talk about that. Talk about how the Arab Spring changed the way some young women in places like Egypt and Yemen and Libya and Tunisia thought about their own rights and what they deserved.
So I'll tell you briefly about Noor. I start the book with her. Noor was a 13-year-old girl when in the book when it opens. And she grew up in Tunisia before the Arab Spring, which was a very authoritarian, repressive place in a very secular way. So Noor, as a 13-year-old, showed up for high school one day wearing a headscarf. I mean, much of Tunisian society is quite traditional, conservative. She felt that to be, you know, a pious, good Muslim girl, she had to cover her hair. And she was slapped by her teachers. She was thrown out of school. She was sent home and suspended. So she sort of sat out. She became a high school dropout because in the Tunisia of that time, which really policed people's piety as part of its system of repression, you couldn't be a visibly religious girl and participate in public life and go to university. So that became part of Noor's language of rebellion, was to embrace her religion. And so after, and this is a very Tunisian story, and I won't go too much more into the details of it, but after the revolution, there was a flow of activism. The kind of pathways opened for this kind of religious politics that hadn't been allowed. And of course, there was a radical fringe to that that really exploited the hopes and aspirations of young girls like Noor.
What did her social class have to do with the way she ended up rebelling against authority?
I think for a lot of young women in Tunisia, and I think this is part of the story in lots of other places too, in a lot of these uprisings, there was always a kind of urban working class core that was a little bit more radical than the middle class revolutionaries. Their demands were a little bit higher. They were willing to press a little bit harder. And it's because their circumstances were, to start with, I think, you know, much more challenged and poor. So it wasn't as though, you know, she had a lot of other opportunities. I think this is the case for a lot of the girls from Europe as well. You know, single parent families, a missing father often, not necessarily, you know, a home filled with books where it was suggested to them or could have been suggested to them, look, you could become a human rights lawyer. If you're worried about, you know, the injustice in Guantanamo and the Rohingya Muslims in Burma, why don't you, you know, study, you know, investigative journalism? It was really for a lot of these girls, you know, a conservative small sphere, they were naive and they were online. And once you're online and naive and idealistic as a young girl and you don't have very savvy parents noticing what's going on with you, you're quite ripe for exploitation.
Why was the Tunisian government before the Arab Spring so resistant to overt displays of Muslim faith?
It was part of its regime of control, and eventually it started to try and use religion to its advantage, and so it became kind of state-controlled religion. So imams in mosques had to be vetted, they had to be approved, they almost became like civil servants. So it was really part of the repressive order of the state, which micro-police people's piety. And of course, you know, that was much of the story in a lot of the countries of the Middle East, is that these very oppressive authoritarian orders, their biggest challengers are moderate political Islamists. So any kind of Islam in politics for them is seen as a quite dangerous challenge to their legitimacy, because those kind of politics are powerful and young people are drawn to it.
So how did Noor find her way to ISIS so that she was living among ISIS members?
So Noor became involved in this political religious movement that became permissible after the revolution. They were very religiously active, part of a movement that really wanted to bring religious politics to Tunisian life. There was, protests to demand, and it all sounds quite strange to us, this very kind of orthodox conservative feminism. There were protests that, you know, Noor was part of this movement that, you know, women wanted to be able to go to university classes wearing face veils. So it was part of a movement that really wanted to be politically empowered, push the boundaries to see how much religion could be inflected back into what had been such a police sphere. And there was a fringe of that movement that had always been quite radical. So there were a couple of terror attacks in Tunisia, and the response was to just shut the whole thing down. So that meant that the moderate kind of activists along the spectrum were shut down along with the hardcore. And that left a lot of young people feeling like there was just no space for them anymore in Tunisia. It was like the clock had been reset to the days of authoritarianism. And that's when ISIS came in recruiting, saying, look, they were never going to give you a chance. They were never going to allow this. If you really want to be true Muslims, if you want to have participation in public life the way it was promised to you, come here, come to Syria. You can do it here. And there were recruiters who would get, $500 a head. And they prayed very actively and they were very organized. And that's how Noor was kind of lured in.
My guest is journalist Azadeh Moavini. Her new book is called Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS.
Funding for Think comes from Interabang Books, a locally owned shop with a hand-picked selection of books and gifts for adults and kids. In Dallas at the corner of Preston Road and Royal Lane and online at interabangbooks.com.
Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Azadeh Moavini. She is author of a new book called Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. If you'd like to join us, call 800-933-5372. 17% of the people who traveled from Europe to caliphate territory were women, Azadeh. Talk about the conditions that made young women feel unwelcome in places like Germany and the UK and feel like maybe they would be better off with ISIS.
Well, in London, I'll start with London because I focus on these three schoolgirls, high school students who went to join ISIS from London. They were straight A students. They were popular. They were bubbly. They were remembered, as the girls that everyone liked. Their teachers liked them. They came from immigrant families, so they were second generation from Pakistan or Ethiopia. I think there's, I'm from California, and I don't wear a headscarf, but living here, in Europe, I've noticed certainly that there's a level of kind of everyday racism targeted specifically very often at girls wearing headscarves because they're visibly Muslim. That is, something that is a challenge, I think, for young people who, come from a bicultural background. They're trying to be British or whatever else they are. And I think national identities in Europe are just much more exclusivist. It's really hard to feel all the time British if the papers are full of really sensationalist coverage of how Islam is such a violent religion. A lot of really, I think, for these young girls, and these are things that they tweeted about and talked about on social media before they left, is they just didn't feel like they were accepted as Europeans, as British girls, because they covered their hair. They were told that they were submissive. They felt that they were looked down upon. You could never be feminist because how could you be a feminist if you've got a headscarf on your head? They were in working class areas where were also, there were fairly, noteworthy incidences of hate crimes. I don't mean to paint too bleak a picture, but certainly they started to feel it. And that's something that ISIS really pushed, right? I mean, this was a key part of ISIS messaging, was that they called it the gray zone. The gray zone, they said, doesn't exist. You can't exist as both Muslims and Europeans. And so that was a real part of what was kind of whispered into their ears, that you don't belong. So those challenges that I think ethnic minorities, people of color feel, belonging to both was something that was really manipulated. But then it became a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy almost, because as there were terror attacks in Paris and Berlin and in London, there were more and more hate crimes. And so it became sort of vicious cycle that ISIS did this in the name of its said religion. And young everyday Muslims who were peaceful, law-abiding citizens bore the brunt of the racism and the hate crimes that it elicited.
People might imagine that ISIS is operating, somewhere in the dark web, but in fact, they were on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, things that, we just can easily encounter every single day?
It's astonishing to me now, because now so much of that content has been wiped off these platforms. I think the tech companies have become much more serious. But, you know, as I was reconstructing what these young girls were saying, these London girls were saying on social media, it was striking. I mean, they were across, you know, the mainstream platforms that we all use, that, you know, that my kids will be on, and that maybe if you've got kids, your kids will be on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook. These were the ways that, and of course, you know, their media production was really impressive. So they had both really sophisticated propaganda and messaging, and they were able to put it on all of these, you know, incredibly powerful platforms. I mean, I don't think that this would have existed had it not been for social media.
Another young woman that you write about is Emma, who grew up the daughter of a German-born single mother. Her father wasn't around, but he was a Spanish national. How did she find herself drawn to the culture and faith of her neighborhood friends who were Turkish?
So a lot of the story of the European converts to Islam, like Emma, is like this. There are people who come from fractured homes, kind of outcasts, looking for some meaning or looking for some family or belonging. Emma fell in with, a group of Turkish, German, you know, young people, and she wanted to fit in, and she converted to Islam because it seemed to be like part of, you know, really an important cultural part of that group. And so through this network, she was exposed to a kind of clique of, they're called Salafi or Wahhabi activists. And that's for the sort of strain of Islam that was popularized and is, you know, associated with Saudi Arabia. It's very orthodox and it's very hard line. It has a very us versus them mentality. And there's, you know, a lot of peaceful Salafis, but the strain of jihadism that we see in all different parts of the world is of this brand of Islam. So there was a kind of clique of this kind of activity, and Emma, who, you know, was kind of drawn to, she listened to Tupac, she kind of thought she was an outlaw, really felt rebellious, she sort of shifted all of her rebellion at life against her parents and against German society that she didn't feel like she fit into this kind of hardline extremist, and I wouldn't even call it activism. So it's kind of the story of, you know, young people on the fringes, always vulnerable to cults and to groups that try to exploit them and offer them, you know, kind of like gangs, a sense of belonging. But I mean, also a religious story, I think. And that's, you know, I started out by saying that ISIS isn't a story of religion, but in part it is a little bit, because the strain of hardcore Salafism that is practiced in Saudi Arabia, that can often be peaceful but often is not, is also really propelled the sectarian thinking that is such a the cornerstone of ISIS ideology. And it's kind of hard to connect all these lines that, you know, draw from Iraq to Saudi Arabia to these cities like Dusseldorf and Cologne, but they're there, and kind of understanding the complexity of it is the story.
So we've talked a little bit about some of these women's motivations, and, you know, people may not agree, but I think they can agree that there was a logic to the choices that these people were making. What sort of process reception awaited women who wished to join ISIS when they actually arrived in the caliphate? How were they sort of brought into the organization?
So when they arrived, they were taken to these guest houses, and the title of my book borrows from this idea or evokes it. So the guest houses were places women were taken, where if they were joining a husband who was already there, they waited there to be reunited. And if they had gone to marry there, they were then matched up with a fighter who was kind of appropriate. Ideally, they would speak the same language. Often they didn't, and they would have to communicate, you know, using Google Translate. But what happened is that because these fighters died so quickly, the women were then expected and forced to remarry. So when the husband would die, the woman would be sent to the guest house, waiting to, you know, sit out her 3-month widowhood. That's all that she was given, sometimes less, and then forced to remarry again and again. And it was very cruel. And these guest houses were terrible places. They were intentionally very dirty and crowded to kind of compel women to want to get out of them. And it was here, really, that I think the notions of many of the naive notions that women went to were first crushed in these guest houses, where they realized that they would just be kind of used again and again, you know, kind of passed around husband to husband. And a lot of them tried to escape. And that's why it's kind of hard to have sympathy for women who are now on the outside of the ISIS experience and saying, please let me come home. Like the women, you know, there are camps in the northeast of Syria where these women who were fled ISIS, you know, are living. But this is what they went through. And once, if they tried to get out, they would be imprisoned. Or if they had children, they would have their children taken away from them. And so it was really, these guest houses were kind of the epicenter of ISIS's cruelty against women.
Did something go wrong with the way ISIS treated women, or did it always intend for the caliphate to operate as a patriarchy?
I think it was its sort of central contradiction. It was highly patriarchal and it was highly violent, and it became unsustainable. I mean, the women who went there as very traditional Orthodox Muslim women who wanted to work and be very, very austere, you know, very quickly they rejected it, because I think women were okay with the patriarchy. I mean, very conservative religious women are often, you know, aligned with patriarchy. But it was the violence that they rejected. They thought it was un-Islamic. They thought that it was horrific, and it had nothing to do with, you know, religion or the promises at all.
Were women ever expected to take up arms alongside the male fighters?
That's such an interesting question. I think many of the women thought that they might be able to, and there were a lot of early posts of these young girls from London and Paris wearing, you know, their covering black robes, posing with Kalashnikovs. But really, in reality, ISIS didn't want to offer women a fighting role. There was some target practice as part of the kind of courses that they went on upon arrival. And there were some rumors that in the final days they had asked women, and I think in the final days there were reports of women showing up at checkpoints as suicide bombers, but in terms of really an operational fighting role, it doesn't seem that it's really evidence that ever came to be.
I hadn't realized until I read your book that even at the height of the fighting, there was pretty brisk cross-border traffic into and out of the caliphate. For women who wanted to leave, how hard was it to just take off from the caliphate?
In the earlier period, say 2014 or 15, it was easier. Those Syrian women that I write about in my book, who were from Raqqa, that was their hometown, the city that ISIS made the capital of the caliphate. Those were the girls who were, one was a marketing student, the other was studied English literature and had Jane Austen books on her shelves, and they were all coerced into joining this and wanted to get out as soon as they could. They left at a time when it was not so strictly policed, but they also left at a time when ISIS was ascendant, and so it wasn't so worried about people fleeing its ranks or fighters fleeing its ranks. It was a little bit more fluid, and Turkey still had a much more porous border at the time. And so it became then progressively harder. By sort of late 2015, 2016, it became almost impossible. You could pay, and a lot of women paid to smuggle themselves out, but then you needed to get money, and a lot of women, you know, just didn't have the cash.
My guest is journalist Azadeh Moavini. We're talking about her book, Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is journalist Azadeh Moavini. Her book is called Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. Azadeh, some of the women you profile believed or continue to believe that ISIS had the moral right to attack non-believers in the West and elsewhere. Can you talk about your experience talking to people who held these beliefs?
Many of them were quite young. So you would be talking, I remember talking to Noor, the Tunisian girl we discussed earlier. She was maybe 18 by the time I was interviewing her. She was a young woman. We were sitting by a seaside cafe, palm trees. To her mind, it was really quite black and white. I mean, there's this narrative that I think is quite common in Middle Eastern Muslim communities, families, that the West really abuses Muslims, that it invades their countries, that it, imposes these dictators upon them, this kind of grand narrative of suffering. And in her mind, having been exposed, I think, and, married to someone who had a very jihadist, kind of, you could call it an al-Qaeda vision of the world, if you hurt us and, she could rattle off for you, look, in Afghanistan, you drone strike weddings, you being the West. Mm. This very crude idea that, that Western governments don't shy from hurting civilians, that they see them as casualties, just, expediently. Oops, sorry, you died, 100 people in a drone strike. So to her mind, this is the targeting of people in cafes, innocent people, was justified because it was a return of the same. And it was hard having those conversations because clearly, even if you were to accept the premise that Western governments do that intentionally or unthinkingly, to return evil with evil is wrong, whatever your kind of ethical, moral worldview. But you could sort of see the sense of hopelessness that, America was this mighty, powerful country. It had invaded Iraq, and Iraq was, so violent that it had invaded Afghanistan, and Afghanistan was so violent that women there were struggling, to be able to have any kind of semblance of a life. So it was a grand narrative, and it was an easy one. There's a lot of evidence to point to American wrongdoing, but of course you can also very easily overstate the case and not look at all of the ways in which, her government, other Arab governments colluded, warlords colluded. I mean, there's a whole kind of political economy of inequality that had led to those places. But they were hard conversations in the end because, I think to feel yourself or your identity group so dehumanized, I think it then becomes easier to dehumanize the other side and think that it's legitimate to attack them violently as well.
Did getting to know women involved with ISIS give you a better perspective on why young men were drawn to join ISIS?
It did. It certainly, in a lot of places, it was born of the same experience. Vacuums where states were riven with inequality, extreme repression and brutality in prisons. That's something that we know. I mean, Noor didn't even make it to Syria in the end, but she was imprisoned because her husband had gone to Syria and she was abused in prison, essentially, along with a lot of other people who were, suspected of ISIS membership, but, never went through a trial to prove it, no evidence. So I think that the conditions, exclusion, really, being excluded from politics, being excluded from society, exerts itself powerfully on men and women. But you could really, it was interesting to see the gender dynamic, go back and forth between men and women because, if we go back to the Sunni uprising in Iraq that, you can kind of trace the story of ISIS to then, women started signing up for suicide bombings in Iraq because they were being raped in these Iraqi prisons or women in Abu Ghraib. And then men would invoke, the sullied honor of women as a rallying cry to fight against the Americans. And these are all the precedents of ISIS. So conflict essentially, impacts women in a particular way because often they're the victims of sexual violence and then their humiliated honor becomes a rallying cry for men. So you can sort of see how the corrosive effects of war and the way that it brutalizes a society, of course, vast inequality, disempowerment for both, but what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, and the responsibility to protect women becomes part of, the rallying cry or the narrative that all of these militants espoused.
All right, let's go to the phone. Scott is calling from Coppell, Texas. Hi, Scott.
Hey, I have a question. I'm just curious about ISIS is a very combative kind of place, but I'm almost like a Navy SEALs. But my question is, were women like at the level of men, above or below, and as far as their fighting skills go? That's my question.
Thanks for calling.
So I think there were certainly women who would have liked to have had the chance to fight alongside men, but operationally they were just not given that training. There was still a quite kind of starchy orthodoxness about women and fighting. Of course, at the end, you know, there were rumors that women were given guns or were actually strapped explosives to themselves, and that's something that I think happened at the very end of the ISIS kind of caliphate. But in the times that it was ascendant, it didn't see a view for women in fighting, really.
So as ISIS began to be more and more contained, camps filled up with women who'd been aligned with the group, in many cases with their children. Where are these camps located? Who runs them? What are they like?
Many of these camps are in the northeast of Syria. Syria, after its civil war, has become very fragmented, and there is a portion of the country of the northeast that's run by the Syrian Kurds, who are called the Syrian Democratic Forces. I mean, essentially, they were the Syrian Kurds who fought alongside the U.S. and the coalition against ISIS. So you could almost say, you know, in effect, that area is run by the Syrian Kurds together with the United States military, because those are the two powers that control the area. So there's three camps there, and there's one particularly big one where these women who kind of fled, you know, the final territory of ISIS are held. There are 13,000 foreign women and children in this one camp. 60% of them are children, so huge numbers of children. And it's a place where it's very violent. It's very it's full of disease. It's a humanitarian catastrophe, really. I mean, when I was there in June, there were malnourished, skinny babies, and children were dying regularly, because it's such a security humanitarian problem all at once. Essentially, a lot of these European countries, you know, these women, many of them are European or North African, won't take them back for a variety of reasons, political, security concerns, and so really, all these quite hardcore ISIS women are mixed in with a lot of women who are very vulnerable, who rejected the group, who want nothing more than to have nothing ever to do with it again. But they're kind of contained there in the desert, and it's really escalating the violence there. And I think it's a big crisis for European governments. And the U.S. President Trump actually tweeted about it a couple of months ago. He said, you know, Europeans have to take their citizens back. And I think it's an instance where really right now the United States is taking what to my mind is, you know, the really principled higher position, trying to push Europe to do the same.
Is there an effort at least to repatriate the children who had no say in where they ended up because of their parents' decisions?
There is, and within the reluctance to bring anyone back at all, orphans are kind of seen as a separate category. And there have been repatriations of orphans. I was there in June when there was a Belgian team who was trying to repatriate six orphans. And these children have, you know, terrible wounds. You know, many of them were caught up in the fighting, so they have shrapnel still embedded in their bodies. And they're all very young. A lot of them are under eight. A lot of them are even younger. So this idea that, you know, really gets fed in the press, especially the far right spreads it, that they're radicalized. I mean, they're too young to even really be to be developed to have that. So they are slowly being taken back, but very slowly. And I think it's a quite scary place for those who are left to be.
The new book by journalist Azadeh Moavini is called Guest House for Young Widows Among the Women of ISIS. Azadeh, this has been such an interesting conversation. Thanks very much for making time to speak with us.
It was my pleasure to talk to you.